Hello, everyone. My name is Joshua Gilliland, and I am one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me to discuss The Mandalorian, The Pirate, is Stephen Tollefield and Thomas Harper. Stephen, how are you?
Doing good, thanks. Just excited about our weekend last weekend from WonderCon. It was a great panel, a great turnout, good conversations. It was fun.
Yes, it was. And Thomas, how are you doing?
I'm slowly growing the first beard that anyone has ever seen on me.
You saw it here first.
I know. Yes, this is a Legal Geeks breaking special. I'm fresh off of two sort of back-to-back intense work things, but one of them was fun and involved a very Legal Geeks centric program out at PAX East in Boston. We held a panel on video games and legal issues, specifically with the law of war in those. So that was a lot of fun. And I think this is the first time where at virtually simultaneous moments, the Legal Geeks were active on both coasts at shows. So that was a momentous occasion.
Yeah, we can fight a two-front war. So it's why we have a 600-ship Navy. So let's talk a little bit about the event. You and Gabby were there. What topics did you hit with that panel?
Yeah, so interestingly, we wanted to steer away from actual war simulation games. It's kind of easy to, and low-hanging fruit to talk Call of Duty and games like that. So we focused on games like Mario Kart and Zelda and Star Fox and things like that, and really looked at a wide array of core issues within the law of war, everything from mercenaryism, which is very, very prevalent. We'll probably have some talk about that in this episode. Looked at that through the lens of Star Fox, since that game, you bill for your services after every battle. So that made an interesting example. With Mario Kart, we're looking at the weaponry that's used. So everything from the fake item boxes that blow up when you hit them, to your guided missiles in terms of the red shells, to blast damage of a blue shell if you get hit as a first place player. So it was a really inventive way. I think it was an exposure for this crowd that is on par with the reception that we've seen with other groups elsewhere. It's just that I don't think, to my knowledge, we've ever done anything at a video game centric conference. And it was nice to break into that audience. But a full house, we packed out the room on a Thursday night of all things. And very similar to our other Legal Geeks panels, just a lot of folks that are energized and engaged afterwards. We got swept out of the room summarily after going like 20 minutes over just with the informal discussions with some fans. So that was really neat to see. And it's further proof. People ask, in an environment like that, or Comic-Con, or you pick your convention, with everything that's going on, why would somebody pick a legal panel to go to? And just another chapter in the proof of what we're able to do and how we're able to connect with people.
That's fantastic. I'm glad you guys had a good time. And, you know, people care about the law, which is why they will, because we're a nation of laws where people can be free to live as they want. Stephen and I tackled a bunch of those topics in kind of a dark manner, with focusing on Andor and Kenobi for civil rights in the time of Star Wars at WonderCon. Stephen, can you share your memories of that that panel?
Yeah, it could have been called the lack of civil rights in the time of Star Wars, because obviously there are very few in the time of the Empire. And it was really interesting to talk a little bit about the issues that came up both in Obi-Wan Kenobi and in Andor, a lot of which involved, of course, Fourth Amendment rights of the accused, searches and seizures, arrests. Also, we got a chance to talk a little bit about prisoner civil rights, which was really one of the things that I'm personally kind of really interested in, or the lack thereof again. And so it was a great panel, some really good questions. We went up the full time, And it was great con too. I was only there on Sunday. I know you were there the more of the weekend, Josh, but it was a great crowd, really good vibe, really fun.
I agree. Yeah, it was WonderCon was fantastic. I drove down. I left at 3:45 a.m. Friday morning, so I could get there in time to one, do some work because I had to do work. But two, my buddy Sean Thorson was on a special effects panel talking about 3D printing and mold making, and it was cool to go see him present. So like we both grew up in Sea Scouts at the same time. We competed against each other. So we've been friends for over 30 years. And we both go to cons and we do very different things at the cons, even though we both do panels. He makes amazing costumes. On Sunday, he was walking around dressed as Dark Helmet from Spaceballs, looking fantastic. His girlfriend was the armorer on Saturday. Amazing. And she was getting stopped frequently for people to take pictures with her. I started Christmas shopping and just had a rip-roaring good time and got to hang out with a whole bunch of other great lawyers and judges, being able to nerd out on the law and just be with other members of the community who love this stuff. And being able to go like, hey, I want to go get X. I want to go get somebody a t-shirt or Funko Pop. We did have an adventure afterwards going to, since we're at Anaheim. So we went to Downtown Disney and we went to the outpost to pick up some goodies. I did get the Han Solo Frozen in Carbonite blanket. And it's like, why would I turn that down? One of our other lawyers said that she regretted not buying the beach blanket that said, I hate sand. So
I didn't see that. That's amazing.
It was no longer there. So
got it.
Christine was upset that she should have gotten it when it was available. And
did Christine get the Bo-Katan kind of 7-inch figure?
Or did she maybe I'll find out because she was looking at it, but there was the Bo-Katan 7-inch figure was stunning. It's kind of like one of those old style G.I. Joes meets a Barbie doll type of detail. It was just exquisite looking, but lots of goodies in there. And so yeah, some shopping was done for Christmas and birthdays. Because I try to plan ahead, so that way you don't do all your shopping all in December. Because I learned from my grandma. So
it's very wise. I got some new fashion for celebration this week.
My Andor shirt was new, and for those going to celebration, there is someone who's has my wish list for t-shirts, and so all good stuff. So for anyone who might be listening on the plane on the way over. Have fun, you know, go get some jelly babies, go have a good time. So let's get into the legal issues for The Pirate, which, you know, I really think should be called The Pirates, but they do lean in heavily to Yar in this episode, and I do appreciate that. And that Corsair does look pretty awesome. And it raises the instant issue of what is piracy? We've talked about this before, but it's a tale as old as time because pirates are a thing. So how do we define pirates? Whoever on the high seas commits the crime of piracy as defined by the law of nations and is afterwards brought into or found in the United States shall be imprisoned for life. And that's 18 U.S.C.S. Section 1651. Okay, so we take this kind of seriously. Now, we have to break down what all these words mean. High seas means open waters of sea or ocean as distinguished from ports and havens and waters within narrow headlands on coast. And that's U.S. v. Rogers, 150 U.S. 249, 1893. Now, the Convention of of the High Seas states that piracy includes any illegal act of violence, detention, or any act of depredation committed for private ends by the crew or the passengers of a private ship or a private aircraft and directed. And that's 1958 UST Lexis 31, Article 15, Section 1. So the Pirate King and crew clearly are going out to terrorize and take over the town. And in the communication with Greve Karga, where Greve does try bluffing his way out of the situation, they say, no, contact me when you want to surrender, and we're going to now go pillage your town. And all the villagers then leave to go to the lava flats that we last saw at the end of season one. Who amongst us wants to jump into how much piracy is actually taking place here?
So piracy in the modern world is really the modern law that would govern it would be the UN Convention for Law of the Sea, UNCLOS for short. Obviously, we're not dealing with an ocean here, and we've talked about UNCLOS in an earlier episode, and it may have been in the context of maybe Bad Batch, but you have to do some bootstrapping here because we're not in an ocean, right? So UNCLOS is written, distances and whatnot that it uses to demarcate certain rights that a flag state has within waters off of its coast, that really is hard to extrapolate and apply to a planet. Here, it's complicated further because we're dealing with issues in Atmo, so in atmosphere, as opposed to Gorian Shard when he was just, you know, flying around in orbit or on Navarro. But nonetheless, UNCLOS has a whole section on piracy, and really interestingly, it's important to note that there's this sort of universal, like global effort to get rid of piracy or to combat it. It's one of the few areas in international law where most countries have this sort of lockstep mentality against it. And you see that reflected in how UNCLOS approaches piracy, in particular because of jurisdiction. So you mentioned the concept of high seas, this idea that in certain areas of the water, the traditional laws of a state really don't apply. It's a sort of Wild West area. Interestingly, with regard to pirates, there's what's called universal jurisdiction that exists over pirates. So no matter what flag you're flying, if there's piracy that's committed on the high seas, there's criminal jurisdiction that can attach by virtue of whoever is engaging them. Here, I think you're talking like really close range to Navarro and the settlement there. You're talking something like territorial waters of a state. So, in other words, in our world, the area outside of a country or in a country's waters that they have sort of the most control over. So it'd be like, you know, rolling up into San Diego Bay as opposed to being out in the Pacific Ocean a few nautical miles. So here, I think what we see happening and the actions that Greve Karga takes, I think fit pretty squarely with the modern laws concept that a state is going to be pretty well empowered to combat piracy and use force, cause things like death and destruction, and they're not going to be held to account for those things. There's not the sort of like civil liability that might exist if you were doing these things. In other words, if you're the pirate and your corsair gets downed over Navarro, you're not going to have the ability to go sue the flag state over this. And that is just an extension of those protections from UNCLOS.
So throw in a little history to compare it to Navarro. In the early 19th century, end of 18th century, so it's the Jefferson administration, we pass a force bill to go after the Barbary pirates because piracy was a problem. And we waged war on the pirates. And so when, you know, from the hauls Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. That's where that part of the song comes from, for us taking out pirates. What is Navarro's status with Grief Karga asking for help? Does that make them a nation state or a city state? Because Navarro is a big planet, and you basically have one thriving town that's still pretty small. So it's like Jamestown type of situation, where they're, you know, they have trade happening. So he makes a request for help to the New Republic, to our favorite X-Wing pilot now. And is there a state of war taking place here? Is this a legitimate ask for a city-state to be seeking military aid to take care of the invaders? Now, Tom, you know, you're our law of war guy. What do you think?
Well, and I think it's reasonable to assume that if something like this law existed in the New Republic there, I should back up. It is clear that the New Republic regards them as a sovereign entity. There's this whole back and forth about whether the New Republic is going to bring military force to their aid. And the discussion is not Navarro is just this backwater settlement. It's that they have not signed on. They're not a member state. And so I think that suggests recognition of the planet, of that settlement, whatever the case may be, as a sovereign entity, as somebody that could be signed on and be a New Republic member state or world, but they're not. If you look at UNCLOS, so it's an international treaty, and international treaties have to be ratified or assessed to by countries signed on to. And this is a great example that has some apt comparisons in the Star Wars universe, because you have 164 UN member states that have either ratified or acceded to UNCLOS. Not all of them are countries like the United States. A place like Cabo Verde ratified in 1994. The Cook Islands have ratified. Benin on the west coast of Africa, a very small country. Djibouti ratified. So in the real world, lots of countries have signed on to this. And a lot of that, I think you can trace to their interest in some of the provisions for it. They want some of the protections that this law offers. Piracy is probably a driver in some of those cases. And so just like in our world where you have these like postage stamp size countries, like it'd be reasonable to assume that Navarro, at least in the wake of this incident, is going to be looking for some of those same more robust protections from the Republic.
In our world, you know, we have the War Powers Act, where if the president sends in troops, they have to alert Congress within 48 hours that American troops are being put into harm's way. There are a few examples of that after, this came about after Nixon. So the Mayaguez incident, which was a merchant ship was taken, Ford waited like 54 hours to tell Congress, just to kind of give them the middle finger on it, but he still complied with it. Reagan did as well for Grenada. And this, the idea of sending in troops or air support, at least to take out the Pirate King, I think sounds like a Mayaguez or Grenada type situation, because this shouldn't be like the Gulf War one of getting the Iraqis out of Kuwait. It seems more specific that it's one targeted ship that needs to be disposed of. And part of me just wished that, you know, the outpost of New Republic fighters just had taken action, because it reminded me of Baba Black Sheep, a little bit of MASH, different Vietnam stories that, you know, you send in, and it's like, well, there are pirates. There's like 20 of us. You know, we're not doing anything right now. And the fact that they blew up a space station, you know, back in The Prisoner, like, just take out the pirates. Don't ask for permission. So I thought that was just a little weird because time is of the essence. And so I thought there would have been enough of a, you know, exigent circumstance for them to have just scrambled to go fight the pirates. But they needed to get the Mandalorians there. Stephen, your thoughts on this?
I would just chime in. I think Thomas's observation about the maybe motivation to join the New Republic is maybe there now, although I'm wondering how much they'll be inclined to do that now that they have engaged their own security forces by doing a little swap of land to get some kind of frontier justice gunslingers on their side. So remains to be seen, I guess. But it also seems like, you know, the Mandalorians, Din's buddies in the New Republic are really interested to help, kind of want to be there. So maybe they will have some more official law enforcement, maybe some additional military protection going forward.
Yeah, that was just, I mean, just very cowardly, and to show bureaucracy in full swing and listening to a former Imperial with, well, maybe if they hurt enough, they'll come to us for help. Not if they cast out the invaders on their own. It's just, no, no, that's not how this works. There are other foreign policy examples that come to mind, but won't go down those rabbit holes. But no, it's just, that's not how foreign policy works, that we'll wait for them to be bombed before we'll take any action. No, be the good guys.
I love that it taps into a broader sort of set of political themes and undercurrents that stretch into the sequel trilogy, though, because this is the kind of thing that's the seed of ultimately what grows into the First Order, and sort of maybe less the First Order as an entity and more so either the agnostic attitude of the galaxy toward an organization that exists or crops up like that, or the outright support where they say, hey, you know, over the last 30 years, what's the New Republic done for us? It's just like the last centralized government. And if you've read the excellent Claudia Gray book, Bloodline, you know, this existential argument over centralized government versus decentralized government and putting the power in the hands of, in that case, the planets, permeates through the New Republic's early existence. So I thought this was, I don't know if they intended this to touch on those themes, but it was a nice touch.
I haven't read the book, so I gravitated in another direction from all the poli-sci and history classes that I took. And that is, you just can't declare peace and walk away. Peace is maintained through strength. And the greatest example of that is post-World War I leads directly to World War II, because you just can't, we're going to punish and then ignore Germany. We're going to take massive reparations where they're going to have hyperinflation. The French are supposed to go in and knock out the German military if it starts building up again. We're going to have a bunch of naval treaties that say you can't build anything like an aircraft carrier, or you can't go across this tonnage. And that doesn't work. It just doesn't work, because a bully will build hypersonic torpedoes to kill us. They don't care. And you need to be able to go, we won't decommission our Navy. We'll keep it up and running, because we have to be able to deter aggression. And the New Republic is just throwing that concept out the window entirely. And it looks like it has a ruling class that as long as they get their bread and circus, they don't care what's happening. So it's just, it might be why Palpatine was able to survive, because elites on Coruscant didn't care. So, but yeah, you have to be willing to lead, and you have to have a foreign policy to fight aggression, because if you don't, they'll just keep rolling over.
It's interesting because how the empire was all about security through show of force, and we're just making the galaxy safer, and that was kind of their way of selling their totalitarianism to the public. So it seems like the New Republic has just swung the opposite direction in a way that's maybe not sort of long-term sustainable, but it's interesting how this is exploring the line between security and being totalitarian, which is kind of an easy line to cross, I think.
Yeah, you need to maintain defenses. That doesn't mean go out, we're going to go expand. Like, that's where things go sideways. Like, it's when they go, we're going to protect trade routes and civil liberties to make sure that aggression doesn't come in and start rolling over the defenseless. It's quite another thing to go, we're going to go out and colonize and take over places, because then it flips. So there is, you know, you have to walk the middle so you don't. I mean, it's just our Navy deterred the Soviet Union. It deters Russia, you know. And like the other night in line at Walmart, I heard, or excuse me, Walgreens, a guy was watching a TikTok video saying we should end all aid to Taiwan because we need to do business with China. It's like, that's a democracy. And you want the fascist totalitarian nation to just roll it over. Scary, super scary.
There was an interesting just one-off line from Tim Meadows' character where he does talk about they're in the middle of decommissioning the Republic fleet. So it's a real, that's a controversial topic in canon in Star Wars, a decision driven by Mon Mothma, to the chagrin of many. But it begs the question, there's limited resources for this sort of thing. And piracy is, I would say, on the rise in the vacuum of the empire. And so that they're having to make tough and in many cases, borderline inhumane choices about where to invest their resources. There's one of the first trilogies of books, the Aftermath trilogy. There's a whole like side story about a pirate who, in the wake of the Battle of Jakku, gets a hold of a Superstar Destroyer, and they're just operating with this Superstar Destroyer. I mean, like, that's the level of malfeasance that the New Republic is dealing with. And we're not talking a New Republic that's been around for 15 years. I mean, they're only 4 years out from Jakku. Well, maybe a few years out, but they're still getting their feet under them and trying to deal with the situation.
So, you know, after World War II, we decommissioned a good chunk of the Navy. We demilitarized to an extent to make it realistic for the threat that was then at issue, because we weren't fighting a two-front war. Now, we did have a huge Navy through the entire Cold War because we had to match the Soviets. But our tech was better, so we needed fewer things. Well, they went, we'll make things cheap and make our sailors glow in the dark from bad nuclear cores. And again, we won. But yeah, they can't. It's just so irresponsible. You can't just declare peace and walk away. Not when there's millions of fascists wanting to kill you. Like, that just, it's like going, don't worry about that cancer. I'm sure it won't be malignant. So what could go wrong? Let's talk about the duty to aid Navarro. Like, we just danced around it. But did the New Republic have a duty to aid them? I don't think so. Did the Mandalorians? Again, I don't think so, but that's what makes them cool. I really love the fact they have a talking stick.
Yeah, we got to see a little Mandalorian democracy such as it is in action. That was pretty cool.
You know, and it highlighted my prediction that we would never have a problem with Paz Vizsla. Like, after you save his kid, it's like, we're good.
Yeah. We're good. I'm not the squeaky wheel anymore.
I'm on board. Let's go do this.
The 6'8" squeaky wheel.
Well, that, you know, his comment was about they want us to have a brighter future. And it's just like, okay, if they could win him over, going to play Liberator makes a whole lot of sense. Let's get into a non-international armed conflict with the Mandalorian covert versus the pirates. And Thomas, help us through this.
Yeah, it occurred to me. So the New Republic says, no, we're not going to send our glorious Y-Wings into battle. And so you're left with the covert versus the pirates. And in our world, there are sort of two flavors of armed conflicts that really dictate the laws that are in play for that armed conflict. One of those are conflicts with a non-international character. So the United States is very familiar with NIACs for short. So Afghanistan, Iraq, both very prevalent NIACs over the last 20 plus years. It's interesting here because you could have a non-international armed conflict declared between these two entities, even though neither of them is like the official military of Navarro. Just like in our world, you could have, say, ISIS and you know, a Kurdish militia force at war in Iraq or in Syria, and have that meet the same threshold. The legal test for a NIAC is in place to distinguish between what we call like international or internal disturbances. So riots, traditional like flare-ups in civil society of violence don't rise to the level of a NIAC. And that's an important distinction to make, because you don't want to apply the law of war to every single internal riot or disturbance like that. It just would be unworkable. So the law puts in place a standard that really looks to the intensity and the organization of the armed conflict. And that the organization really looks at the parties fighting the armed conflict. And so here, I just thought it was interesting whether this covert in some way, shape, or form represents Mandalore, whether there's an argument to be made now that Bo-Katan is part of the covert. They have the dark saber with them. They're small, and that certainly would factor into the analysis, but they have a command structure. They are well-armed and equipped. They have, in the Star Wars case, they have international or interstellar travel capability. And I thought there's a reasonable argument to be made that A, they're a well-organized military force, albeit a small one. B, there's maybe a stretch argument to be made that in the absence of a Mandalorian government, this is the closest thing to Mandalore that you have still in existence. The pirates, a little bit different. You're really focusing on their organization and sort of the pyramid that ends at Gorian Shard. But I think it's probably a little bit of a stretch to get to where you need to in the legal analysis on the organization side. The intensity is an interesting question, though, because it doesn't have to trigger NIAC. You don't have to have an all-out war with like multiple battles. You look at things like the weaponry that's involved, the number of troops that are involved, the amount of destruction that's caused by the conflict and whatnot. And I think here there's at least a colorable argument that it would meet the intensity criteria. You've got the Corsair bombarding the settlement on Navarro. You have a very destructive, albeit brief, fight between the two sides that results in the destruction of the Corsair and most of its starfighters. And so it's an interesting application of the test, to say the least. I think it falls probably short. We'll see if Gorian Shard's, like his maybe friends out in the galaxy, materialize. Maybe he survived, like Darth Maul style, the crash of his Corsair. I don't know. But yeah, it's an interesting question, and it's determinative of whether you'd apply the rules of war in that particular fight sequence.
I was very concerned the Corsair was going to crash into the town.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised he seemed to be steering it away. It seemed more in character for a pirate to aim it right at the Navarro City Hall.
Yeah, they. I was like, oh, this could get really messy if they shoot it down and it lands on the town, because then there's a lot of urban renewal that needs to take place.
What will happen to the poor Enzelans? Yeah, I don't think they evacuated.
Some of them did.
Very short legs. Yeah. Wouldn't have gotten very far.
Yeah, right.
Run, guys, run.
Well, that's sad. Speaking of taking a dark turn.
I hope somebody went back and you're with me. I will not forget you. So, oh boy, oh boy. Thomas, you also raised the issue of the Mandalorians being mercenaries.
Yeah, this is an interesting twist on something that, at least for sort of more modern Mandos in the Star Wars universe, has always been sort of this this question. You've got a number of Mandalorians that are fit the bill of hired guns. Here you have a contingent of them going into battle at the request of a nation state. And so it begs the question that traditionally under the law, it's a very strict test. It's found in Additional Protocol 1 of the Geneva Conventions. It's a 6-part test that's very, very restrictive, and it was built that way for a reason, because a lot of countries employ a lot of people that look a lot like mercenaries, and countries had a vested interest in tailoring the test so that not all of them would qualify. But one of the central components is compensation, right? You have to be motivated to go fight by material compensation and money that's sort of, it's substantially in excess of what a normal soldier is going to be paid. Here, the interesting question is that they're being given land. So it's an in-kind payment. There's no talk that they're getting any actual credits or money. And it's unclear the value of the land, but it's not an insubstantial tract. And I guess depending on where the zoning law discussion ends with Greef, and as they were like dickering over what zones to place where, that could increase the value potentially of the property. In any event, I don't think that the value of that single tract, when you consider it's sort of divided amongst, like, no single Mandalorian is going to own that entire tract. So I think it's hard to make the argument that even that in-kind payment would reach the threshold. There's also, there's a good teaching point about motivation. So we want, if a mercenary is going to be lawfully categorized as one, we want money to be that motivator. We want that material gain to be what motivates them to go and fight. Here, it's not clear that that's solely the case. They seem to really be motivated to do what's right and to go to aid for people that are in need, sort of fulfill that, like, Mandalorian identity of helping others. And for those two reasons, I think they solidly fail the mercenary definition. I think even if you pay them credits on top of it, there's enough there that they wouldn't qualify under AP1.
Yeah, I don't think so either. They're doing this because they're Mandalorians and it was the right thing to do and they want to have a better future. Like, all of that sounds noble. And again, it's Paz Vizsla with... Because that's what we do. Like, we're going to go fight the bad guys. Saddle up. Okay, very Western. Also very Kurosawa. So again, just like hitting all the right buttons for what we want to see in, you know, a Star Wars story of people deciding to do the right thing.
I wonder if the Mandalorians would disavow that, though, and say, no, we're really mercenaries. We want to be mercenaries. That's, please categorize us as mercenaries.
Can we qualify?
Look at this cool armor.
We can't get a good reputation. Like, that would really mess up our business prospects. If
they'll be perfectly fine as private military security companies, PMSCs. That fits the bill well.
That seems like a good alternative for them.
Yeah. Yes. They just need a Mando accountant, like a Mando HR rep. They've got to have, you know, some semblance of a normal business process.
Yeah. Maybe want some of the older Mandalorians who can't, you know, like, do flips and fight the way they used to. Maybe HR is their future. So
I want to see that sitcom, please.
Mandalorian HR,
the workplace sitcom of
Mandalorian The Office.
I would watch that.
Oh yeah, stay up to midnight to watch the episode drop. Oh, so glorious. Now, Stu and I simultaneously started adding notes about statute of frauds, and we can talk about, there's a lot of contract formation here, but I'll take formation and Stephen, you take the rest. So,
sure. Yeah.
Okay. So episode one, Greef offered to Din the track of land if he would be the lawman. Offer. Comes back in this episode, says, I am taking you up on your track of land. Consideration could be anything from a peppercorn or fighting pirates. So consideration's made. They've changed their position to their detriment in order to get this track of land. Then after the fight, Greef Karga orally states, I am ceding you this land. It is your land now. Our Mandalorian liberators, let's barbecue. And then they do the predator handshake, and it's awesome. Stephen, talk us through the fact that all of this is oral and not in writing.
Yeah, I mean, as I was watching this episode, I was having flashbacks to bar prep when you have your flow chart of like, is there a contract? Is there writing? Like, does it? So, any deal that involves real estate, the statute of frauds requires it to be a contract in writing. And it's California statutes on point two that's Josh found, Civil Code section 1622, which permits oral contracts except the ones that have to be comply with the statute of frauds and be reduced to writing. And as I recall, I think even like leasing real property requires a written contract as long as it can't be executed within 1 year or something like that.
So. Yep. Leasing and contract modification. So. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I was watching the episode, I was like, so we're just going to spit in our palms and shake on it. And that's going to be good. You're going to put that in writing, Greef? Can I see the agreement?
I see the title insurance.
Yeah, exactly. I've purchased a home before. I know that there's a little more paperwork involved than just that. But the other thing too, is that, as you mentioned, Josh, he uses the word seed, which is, and by the way, did you catch it? Was all land from the Western Lava Flats to Bullock Canyon?
Yes.
Reference to Jeremy Bullock. This was sweet. Poor guy. I mean, he passed away in 2020. But what a great callback to the original trilogy, Boba Fett. That was great. To the fine people of Mandalore. And of course, Session is not really a real estate transaction. It's more of an agreement to give land to another entity, which is often comes up in treaties or other sort of agreements between nations. It doesn't come up too much in everyday law practice, but it, you know, for a long time in the sort of the beginning of our country, of course, there's a lot of cession of land from indigenous people to the U.S. government, which popped up from time to time in United States Supreme Court cases, whether that cession was legal based on U.S. federal law. And so there's been litigation of cession sort of locally here in the U.S., but it also comes up when one country surrenders to another in a time of war, something like that. So it seems like they've ceded the land, maybe not necessarily conveyed the property in a way that would require a writing, but probably still worth jotting something down.
Yeah, I would want something in writing because it's who owns it? Like, so
yeah, it's like a tenancy in common now or something, because they all the fine people of Mandalore have an equal undivided interest in the tract of land from the Western Lava Flats to Bullock Canyon.
Yeah, that's going to make title really funky. Like, and how do those folks want to live? Like, so do they all want their own little home? Are they doing this like commune style? Like, we don't know how they live, but I'm pretty sure most people would like their own little home
where they seem like. Yeah, it seemed like Mandalore. Why am I blanking on the name of the city? Help me out.
Sundar.
Sundar. Yeah. Yeah. That seemed like just condo building after condo building. It seemed like they have certainly have figured out how to subdivide interests in a common building.
The other thing, you know, they're going to just accept this land. I remember what's on that land flying around from season one, that those crazy creatures that cut up Grief and almost killed him. So he conveniently, right. Gives over the piece of land that those crazy creatures are still flying around on. So the other thing, it's funny that they touch on like zoning and land, zoning law in that brief scene where Grief is like discussing the zoning districts.
So casually, let's just move the trade district from here to here. And they're all like, okay.
if you tried to do that in a normal municipality, like people would have the old people that volunteer to be on those boards would have an aneurysm.
Yeah. you just hit eminent domain in a pretty serious way, because if there are houses there, or even hell, even if it's just warehouses that somebody owns, that's still property. You can't just take it. There has to be just compensation. And so, yeah, there's going to be a inverse condemnation action, or like they have a whole bunch of procedures that they need to do for, hey man, we're going to sell you your property or buy your property from you, and we're going to give you brand new one over here where it's going to make more sense for you to have your warehouse or your home. Because do you really want to live by the spaceport? Have you lived by an airport? Do you know what a 737 sounds like at all hours of the day?
Good luck selling your house.
Yeah.
Even undeveloped land, there's a keen interest in that. This is like this is my like life prior to, between active duty and coming to the Red Cross, was like land use. But even undeveloped land, there's always a keen interest in how it's zoned, because that can mean the difference between a viable business interest and something that's preserved and you can't build on. You'll see tons of commercial transactions where closing won't happen unless and until certain zoning needs are met. So a property is rezoned, or they get certain variances to be able to you know, do the things that the buyer wants to do on the property, all of which are contingencies for the sale. So it looked like that was a bunch of area that was undeveloped, but yeah, they're not necessarily like free and clear of any interest that might be involved there. But I thought that was like as niche as Star Wars can stumble into is municipal zoning law. But even still, like the description, you talk about him just orally describing the land. That reminds me of just like old property descriptions where it's like the old oak tree on the corner by the creek, and then extending down 100 paces. Legal descriptions of property matter, and that's why surveys exist. And so you have companies whose job it is to come out and produce a mathematical survey of the boundaries of your property for good reason, because as flippant as Grief seems to be about boundary lines here, the Mandalorians want to know what's theirs and what they can do on their property, and probably have a religious interest in making sure that, you know, things are conducted a certain way on that property in the future. So anyways, it was like the funniest, like backwards stumbling into like really weird areas of the law that you can get.
And it was glorious. We are here for it. More of Mayor Apollo Creed. I am totally on board for that show. So are there any other, the CSI element of this, for finding out that Moff Gideon's shuttle was raided, liberated, and he's not there. Okay, so then there's a chunk of Beskar somehow in a bulkhead. There have been a bunch of people talking about how not all Mandalorians have, you know, pure Beskar. You know, it could be a composite of Beskar and something else. And I think Din's first armor that we saw in the first episode was a composite, because it ends up getting broken up by the Mudhorn, and he realizes that he's going to have to start over. So there's that element of maybe it wasn't pure Beskar. And if Mandalorians took him, he would be dead. So that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. And if you're trying to frame the Mandalorians, like if we're dealing with a Grand Admiral Thrawn that, liberated Moff Gideon, like trying to throw misdirection, and what would be the greatest misdirection for Moff Gideon? Beskar.
Yeah, especially since he lost his prized dark saber to the Mandalorians. I'm sure he'd love an excuse for some investigators to finger them instead of him.
Yeah, those are the folks with motive to not want to see the New Republic get to decide his fate.
Yeah.
So, but there's also plenty of Mandalorians that are out there that historically have been sympathetic to the Empire and could be involved in this. Yeah, I think Gar Saxon and his brother Tyber from the Star Wars Rebels series and Clone Wars as well, like big Empire backers and supporters.
If they go that way, that's actually really creative because it ties into the issue that we need to unite all the tribes. And if we have a rogue tribe that's running around with the Imperial Remnant, that's a problem. And so do you try to redeem them or do you try to just fight them to the death? Like what's going to be the game plan here? And what's their motivation to side with Imperial Remnants? As well. So I don't know, but I'm sure we'll find out. The other thing that I spent a little time thinking about was the armorers, the moderate.
She was yeah, the appearance of the Mythosaur has caused a crisis of faith, or at least made her rethink what she thinks she knows. It's interesting.
Bo was comfortable wearing her helmet all the time. It's like, I got a place. These people are cool. And she's on board with it. And so, like, the look on her face post helmet removal was not one of like smiles. She was not happy. I mean, very uncomfortable, just very uncomfortable. And it's the armorer said, you can walk in both worlds. Let's bring everyone together and retake our home world. Good for her. Did not see that one coming. Didn't I thought she'd be more on the religious fanatic side, not the I now have a new plan and we're going to work with people who take off their helmets.
It's the dawn of a new age, she said. The Mythosaur, it's a sign. Yeah.
Only she doesn't believe that Bo has a head injury. That's a positive step.
And she just loves that lustrous new wig she has. She's and it's a shame. It's a shame to hide it under that helmet.
Yeah, it's
Yeah.
and that's the other thing is, telling Katie Sackhoff, you're gonna have to wear a helmet the entire time. It
Yeah.
works for Pedro, but you, it's like, that's a, yeah, it's tough to bury the actress in a headgear that you never see their face. So, but it were, I mean, again, the armor is the moderate, looking for a third path. So people will stop killing each other and they go retake their home and learn to live together again. I was not expecting her to be the dynamic character of the group.
Yeah, it was cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm again just happy to have this. There's so much to talk about, so much fun.
The last thing I'll throw out there is Zeb in live
Yeah.
action.
Yes. So
Giant purple Zeb. I love him so much. I'm so excited.
So when I w watched it at 2 o'clock in the morning, I thought like, oh wow, they got another Lasat that speaks
Yeah.
sounds just like Zeb. And Thomas and I were texting and he hadn't seen it yet. So I left, I didn't say what I thought. And then realizing the credits, it was Zeb.
Yeah. After you mentioned that, I had the same thought. I was like, well, there's no way. It's just another Lasat. That's cool to see it. I think that portends something. Just his existence and the investment that it takes to make that character model.
Yeah, he looks
It's not gonna be,
amazing.
yeah, he looked really, really good. And that's I don't think that's the last time we're gonna see Zeb.
So Merrick in Rogue One had the blue flight suit. Does that indicate anything? Is that a specific rank? Is it like a specific?
It's not a specific rank. I don't think it was unique to Blue Squadron, which he was a leader of. And I don't have any knowledge that this is the first, I think, reveal that Zeb joined the New Republic Pilot Corps in this, or at least the Adelphi Rangers. So, yeah, I think we've got some stories to get filled in on.
Hopefully, Callus is not far behind.
Yeah, it's just who could play Callus? Like, yes. Who could be cast as Callus? Will we still have the mutton chops, or will he have shaved? Like, what's the again? Another dynamic character with somebody who starts out as a bad guy, a serious threat, and then realizes I'm on the wrong team.
Yeah.
I just, you know, it's why I love Rebels so much.
Yeah. It's weird that David Oyelowo did the voice, but the character, like, so they're going to have to figure out someone who can match, or maybe not. Maybe they'll just make David Oyelowo be Callus. I'd be fine with that.
Yeah. It's, well, it's like the, for Cad Bane in Book of Boba Fett, it was the same voice actor.
Mm-hmm.
So they might do something similar. And, you know, the fact they had the three directors, you know, off in the corner drinking with Filoni wearing his hat. It's like, well done. Well done. I didn't catch that until seeing an article about it. But for me, the question is, what does Zeb fly?
Yeah.
What would he fit in comfortably?
Probably a Y-Wing.
Or a U-Wing. Or, yeah, okay, I'll go with Y-Wing.
A U-Wing. Yeah, yeah. I guess a U-Wing.
U-Wing, I think U-Wing.
Pull the seat back.
Now, in the comics, Chewbacca flew an A-Wing, so maybe...
Yeah, right.
Which, again, seems kind of...
I picture, like, his knees popping up in front of the controls.
Yeah, it's just like, that looks really, really messy. There's a reason why pilots were short for a very long time, because you need to fit into the cockpit. You can be too tall to be a pilot. A Y-Wing would make sense, something roomy, something, I think the U-Wing would be make the most sense, but we didn't see any. We just saw X-Wings and Y-Wings.
Mm.
And did either of you, like, sense another show, another, like, did it remind you of anything, seeing that little airfield?
I like what you said about MASH, or, like, yeah, some other sort of military... or like a police station too. It could just be like kind of like a, like the bar at down by the precinct or something.
Yeah. Again, it's, I get Vietnam vibes as well. Like the, cause like they had little airfields, you know, or having attack helicopters operating off of barges. So, you know, there's all kinds of, it felt familiar.
Yeah.
And the music sounded like right out of Visions.
Yeah.
So they just, again, creative team, gold star, everyone gets blue milk, keep up the good work. So with that, everyone, thanks for tuning in. I am beyond thankful that we have so much great content to talk about right now. 9-year-old me would not have believed this would happen one day. So very grateful. And wherever you are, stay safe, stay healthy, and of course, stay geeky.